Welcome back, everybody, to Running in the Fog, episode number 58. My name's Eric Johnson, and I'm here with my kid brother, Derek. Derek, how you doing today?
I'm good. Episode 58. Nice to be on the show with you again, Eric.
That's right. We've got a very special guest provocateur with us here today. Dr. Daniel Sim is with us. Dan, I'm going to get you on here in spotlight. Good morning, Dan. Afternoon, actually.
Morning or afternoon. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Welcome to the show. Dan, it's been such a treat to have you accept our invite. I've been working with you a little bit on some plans there with our work at Concordia University of Wisconsin. I had to dig through my Falcon sophomore's laundry pile in his room to find a t-shirt to appropriately brand the experience here today, make you feel at home. So
welcome. That.
So Dan, give us a little bit of a rundown on your background. You started the School of Pharmacy at Concordia a few years ago. You're really a biotech engineer, I believe, by training. Give us the, you know, quick elevator speech on Dan Sim.
Sure. Okay. grew up in West Milwaukee. I'm actually a biochemist by training. I did my PhD at Madison, and I worked in biotech. Spent maybe 10 years in San Diego. I asked my wife where she wanted to live after Wisconsin, and I couldn't find a job in Hawaii. So San Diego was next best. that's when I got into venture capital and the whole startup world. So I convinced my boss to quit his job, and he and I started a company, basically. And I talk a little bit about that if you want, but it's basically taking advantage of sequencing of the human genome. So I spent 6 to 9 months, very scary 6 to 9 months, without a salary, going into debt, raising venture capital. And we eventually raised a $12 million Series A and a $30 million Series B. So that was kind of drinking from a fire hose for me. So that was my introduction into the biotech startup world. But about 3, 4, 5 years into that, I wanted to come back to the Midwest. I love the Midwest, even though it's cold and foggy right now. But to be here with family and so on, and took a position at Marquette as a chemistry professor, and then Concordia when they started their School of Pharmacy. I was there in the very beginning in their School of Pharmacy, although I wouldn't really say I started it. I was the person that really got the research program going in the School of Pharmacy. And then that sort of morphed into, with me being involved in a lot of startup companies and entrepreneurship, strangely morphed into me becoming the dean of business at Concordia and helping them get their new building in place. And now I'm on to something new. As of 6 months ago, I'm vice provost for research and innovation for the university. But throughout all of this, I've been sort of an entrepreneur, either starting companies myself or helping people start companies. So that's a bit of the theme in my life. So.
Fantastic. Well, Dan, what a background. I know that you've got a few patents to your name and a whole bunch of academic articles. So you, I looked a little bit into your background. You also wrote a book last year called, and I tell us the name of the book. I'm going to try and find your website so that we can get people to go check you out.
Yeah. The name of the book is Purple Solutions, a Bipartisan Roadmap to Better Healthcare in America. At the time I wrote that, that seemed not as crazy as it seems right now. I don't know if anything bipartisan is possible, but yeah, my background is really in development of drugs and therapeutics. So I'm a biochemist by training, but this book was my effort to sort of expand into what I think are the bigger problems in healthcare in America, which is, you know, of course we do need new medicines, that's for sure. But we really have a dysfunctional healthcare delivery system in America, even though we have great healthcare. And so this book was more of a policy and sort of the business and economics of healthcare. That was the attempt. And I had this illusion or delusion that it could be bipartisan. I still think it could be if politicians would actually talk to each other.
Right.
Yeah.
That's super exciting. Derek, do you have any questions for Dan while I queue up a couple of things here to get us prepared for the next section?
I like that book cover, by the way, Dan. It's really cool. why did you name it Purple Solutions?
Yeah, so purple because Republicans red and Democrats blue coming together. So that's sort of the vision behind all of this. I actually I love to involve students when I can in things in sort of real world experience. So we had some graphic design students designed the cover for a stipend for this as well. So, but that's the concept. And we have healthcare summits at Concordia every summer, and we bring in kind of thought leaders, CEOs, physicians, providers, entrepreneurs, and politicians. The very first one we had Governor Walker here, but last summer we had seven current and former senators and representatives. And the goal is really just to educate the public and politicians about what's going on in healthcare and what possible solutions might be. Not that we have them all, but just to get an intelligent bipartisan discussion going. And so it's purple because we really want solutions and we want to fix a highly broken system. And we do need at some point Republicans and Democrats to not be at each other's throats all the time. So,
sure thing. After I said that, I looked at a little bit of the detail to cover, and I thought that was about the dumbest question I could possibly ask. So forget
not me. At all, but ask me a question and I'll talk.
I mentioned in the kind of as we were watching Eric get going with some of the background logistics, I went to a basketball game like last night, and I did not get enough sleep. The next question for you is this. You know, when you think about the difference, you know, talking about raising Series A and B financing and venture capital, and that's obviously a world that a lot of founders operate in.
Yeah.
You think about that world and needing to deliver to your investors a certain sort of return, obviously, on that money versus, you know, sort of an infinite mindset sort of way of thinking, which I'm going to assume is sort of more akin to what your book is driving at, like thinking long-term solutions to, you know, some wicked problems that require creativity and bipartisanship and other things to actually work.
Yeah.
How do you balance between the two? So that whole delivering, you know, a certain return to investors, or, you know, the win, if you will, maybe a little shorter run way of thinking about it versus the longer run, you know, Eric and I would call it the playing to keep playing philosophy or mentality. I'm just kind of curious how you think about that.
No, that's a really good question too. And I try to stay grounded in reality a little bit, which is not something most universities are known for. There's a famous quote from Kissinger that I can't quite remember, but if you want to have people argue the most about things that really don't matter, that's what happens in universities. So yeah, I'm trying to be different at Concordia and have an applied approach, which is why I have actual healthcare leaders and practitioners. We have the president of the AMA speak and others. So to answer your question, I'm talking about in the book, and happy to talk now about some real structural problems and how we do healthcare in America. And you're right, it's not as though we're going to get the government to make any changes in the next 6 months or maybe 6 years. But here's what I do believe in, because I'm an entrepreneur and I believe entrepreneurs are always making the world a better place, or most of the time anyways. And they're the disruptors. And I'm mostly wanting to support the disruptors who are trying to do good things in healthcare. If you were to look at my book, you'd see I talk a lot about this thing called direct primary care, which is delivering healthcare without using insurance, just paying cash. So look at Mark Cuban, for instance, with the access to medicines and drugs directly without using insurance. So my pragmatic approach to solving healthcare is just to support and give a platform for the entrepreneurs that are already changing healthcare. It's just the public isn't aware of it yet because we're stuck in the old mindset. So I'm not necessarily waiting for government to do anything positive, because I'm not sure I believe they can. I'm more wanting to give voice to the entrepreneurs that are changing it, you know. There's a lot of things I like and a lot of things I don't like about Steve Jobs, but you always talk about customer discovery and listen to what the customer wants. Steve Jobs was sort of an anarchist, and I'm not sure I'm promoting this, but he sometimes said, you know what, the customer doesn't know what they want. I can see it and I'm going to create it and they're going to love it. And I think that's kind of a little bit of what's going on in healthcare. I think we're so used to a dysfunctional system that we can't envision how it could really work. And there are entrepreneurs that are Jobsian-like that are creating a disruption that we're going to see in a few years.
Nice. That is very exciting because I completely agree with you. And as I describe myself as a constitutional anarchist, actually, government's role is to guarantee my freedoms. Yeah. They're in the Constitution, and that's kind of it as far as I'm concerned. So we're going to, let's jump into that constructive disruption of the U.S. healthcare system in about 1.5 minutes. Before we do that, I want to draw everybody's attention to a QR code that you see on your screen. That QR code is a POAP, a Proof of Attendance Protocol token, which is a Web3 instrument that gives you access to privileges in our universe that if you don't claim it, you don't even know they exist. So if you haven't scanned that yet, please go ahead and scan and claim that. If you don't know what a Web3 NFT token is, then you can use that to enter your email address and reserve the token for yourself, and we'll send you instructions later. This first 30 minutes we call unthinkable. We're getting into some areas that are going to really make you think about things differently, and that's what Dan's here to do, actually. Dan's going to help us think the unthinkable in the first half, and then in the second half, we're going to cut all the social streams and go and speak about the unspeakable. Unspeakable will be led by our three interlocutors, and there's one slot left. We've had two people claim the interlocutor slots for Dan already. Terry and Teresa, you two are going to be on deck. We'll probably do a ladies first thing since I'm old fashioned that way. So we'll make it Teresa, then Terry. We've got one slot left open for you guys in the audience on the bridge to join. And if you'd like to be an interlocutor and you're watching this on social, jump over to openrecon.com, find the link and register to get on the bridge, and then rejoin us back here on the bridge for the second half. So with that, Dan, tell us a little more about this constructive disruption of the U.S. healthcare sector and where you would start, since government's not going to do it for us.
Yeah, and I don't expect government will. I mostly want them to not create barriers to the solution that I think is coming. So, you know, there was a great book a few years ago by David Goldhill called Catastrophic Care. And he talked about how it's strange in the U.S. how we call this thing insurance, healthcare insurance. But we don't treat it like insurance. We treat it as a subsidized delivery of healthcare for ourselves. So he's suggesting what I'm promoting. He suggested it before me. And there are others in this camp, including Mark Cuban, I would say. So, but Mark Cuban has a bigger audience than I have. But the idea is to simply not use insurance for most of your healthcare. So and then when something very bad happens, you have a heart attack, you need bypass surgery, something that's going to cost maybe $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, then you use insurance. So by analogy, you know, when your car needs a new carburetor, you need new tires, you wouldn't use your insurance for that. That'd be crazy. You know, you'd just be putting the power in somebody else's hands to make, you know, routine decisions for yourself. So, but when your car is totaled, yeah, then you use insurance. So that's what David Goldhill is suggesting. David went on to start a company called Sesame Care, which is doing just this. So you get all your healthcare through a membership. Actually, Wendy Malaska, who's the president of the Wisconsin Medical Society, has her own direct primary care clinic out of Madison. And so the idea is, for generally less than $100 a month, you get 24/7 access to a doctor. And then when you need simple things, you know, routine medicines and whatnot, you can use sort of the direct pay. You know, probably a lot of you have had the experience where you have a prescription drug, you know, for example, maybe Prozac or something, that is $200 if you use your insurance, but if you actually paid cash, it'd be $25. So that's a very common phenomena, and, you know, lab tests and things like that. If you, Wendy Malaska, who I mentioned earlier, she talked about lab tests that if you send out, it'd be $150. And then for her, it's $2. So, wow. So there's this huge sort of, essentially what's happening in healthcare is there's a transfer of expenses to places where it shouldn't be transferred. You're essentially paying the overhead for the hospital, all of that for routine things, which is why I say you should sort of shed all of that and then just, you know, pay directly, use a direct primary care physician, that kind of thing, and then have insurance that layers on top of that. Now, the big insurance companies, I believe, will adjust to this disruption. I think initially they probably stand to lose a little bit, but they'll pivot where they act like actual insurance companies, and then they'll layer on top of direct primary care. But there's a little bit of resistance to this happening, and the people that are making money from this are probably the ones resisting, and they're the ones that have the ears of the politicians who get educated by healthcare by the big providers and whatnot.
I was going to say, you know, there's a lot of vested interests at stake when you do this. But let me tell you something. You just made my day, and you actually made my December, because in about 8 days, I have to decide whether to change my Quartz healthcare coverage. And hey, Quartz, how you doing? I mentioned you by name because you raised my health insurance premium by about 12% this year. And it's about the lowest it's gone up in as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
So I need Wendy's contact details, because she's about to become our new primary care physician as soon as I get off the phone with you here, Dan, because I'm now going to downgrade from the gold plan to the, I don't know, I think it's made out of tin at the lowest level, but maybe it's the bronze plan.
It's the bronze, yeah.
Derek might do that with you, I don't know. But that's really exciting. I'm really, really pleased to hear that.
Yeah, and that's the way, you know, in theory, that's maybe how high deductible plans should be used. You know, you shouldn't maybe use the insurance to pay for routine things, just use it when something big happens. And then, you know, if you need hip surgery, maybe you're willing to pay $3,000 or $5,000 for your copay. But what happens now is we buy all the routine things, which are dramatically overpriced, until you hit your $2,000 deductible, and then you go on a medical shopping spree and you get all those things done. So it's just, exactly. it's a weird system.
It's insane. Derek, you unmuted for a reason.
I think the fear of the catastrophic, you know, car accident, craniotomy, heart surgery, yeah. You name it, will keep a lot of people from moving in that direction. And the big insurance companies will do a good job of instilling fear in people that, you know, your high deductible plan may not, you know, accept some of those types of conditions, whether existing or new or however that looks. But I'm also attracted to that idea. My question for you is, you know, at some point, you know, many of these insurance companies have so much cash on hand that, you know, again, protecting their turf, would it ever be reasonable to assume that a big insurance company may acquire the disruptive candidate just to take them out of the game and sort of take the nuisance away?
Sure, I think that's possible. I should say there are brokers and insurers who actually embrace this direct primary care world, and they'll work with you to layer insurance on top of it. And I do believe that at some point the big insurers will come around, you know, whether there's anti-competitive behavior, yeah, for sure. But I wouldn't put it all on the insurance companies, because I think it's the provider networks as well, which are, they're actually charging the inflated prices, you know, not for necessarily any nefarious purpose, but because they're covering an inflated overhead. And, you know, there's way too many hospitals and beautiful buildings and administrative staff, and you got to pay for all of that somehow, and you pay for it with this thing called overhead. So all hospitals and provider networks have what they call the charge master, which is their negotiated prices that the insurance company will reimburse at, and they're higher than they should be. And you, as a purchaser of insurance, you never really care about that, because magically the insurance pays for it. But, you know, now you're actually having to pay these charge master prices, which are sort of inflated prices. So yeah, I mean, I think there will be sort of anti-competitive efforts in that regard. And, you know, you can look at what's going on in the hospital world. There's merger after merger after merger. So I think people generally think what the solution is a bigger sort of medical industrial complex, that's the solution. But I sort of think the solution is the opposite, which is to empower smaller provider physician groups as well. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it'll be a battle, but I think in the same way that, you know, Uber just kind of jumped in there is if you get to the masses and people understand this is good, they'll adopt it. And then the industry will have to adjust to it as well. So,
right. That's cool. Suck the money out, and you know, the minds tend to follow.
Yeah.
What's that about? Show me the incentives and I'll show you the future. Speaking of incentives, I claimed my Unthinkable POAP while you guys were talking just now. And those of you who haven't done that yet, you've got about 8 minutes before that disappears from the screen. If you haven't joined the bridge yet, sucks to be you. But we have a question actually from Kurt in the audience. Kurt asks, is Dan familiar with John Torinus, chairman of Serigraph in West Bend, who has also written extensively on healthcare, especially in Wisconsin? Curious if he has similar reactions to recent mergers among health systems like Gunderson Lutheran in Berlin, for example.
Yeah, I know John well. In fact, when we started our healthcare economics summit, John was the brains behind all of it. So John helped me with the first summit. He spoke at the first summit as well. He's got a great book, The Grassroots Healthcare Revolution, and then he's got a follow-on book, How Serigraph Solved Healthcare. So also really great books. John's a cool guy too. He's like one of the most outspoken people you'll meet. So, I'm on his mailing list, by the way, and he's got some comments about the recent mergers that were announced in Wisconsin, and I think he's not happy about it. So I'm very like-minded with John as well. I think, I know in the early days, everybody was sort of advocating for this kind of price transparency so that you could see how much things cost, and then you have the ability to shop. So essentially introducing kind of free markets into healthcare. I know early on, John was an advocate of that. I don't know how it's evolved. I will say this, is that it's been hard to implement because there is no price transparency. You can't go to the hospital and say, okay, I need knee surgery. I'm curious how much that's going to cost. You should try that just for fun, because you're going to like be on hold for an hour and people are going to say, we can't figure that out. How would we figure that out? Of course, they're going to figure it out when they bill you later on with your $5,000 deductible. So right. Congress actually forced, initially under the Trump administration, but it continued under Biden. So in theory, even though they never admitted it's bipartisan, they're forcing hospitals to be price transparent. So if hospitals are not price transparent, they are given a penalty, a large penalty. They've been slow to adopt this because they've said it's impossible for us to tell people how much things cost up front. How on earth are we going to tell you what a surgery costs? My gosh, there's the cost of the surgeon. There's the cost of the room. We got to pay the nurses, you know. And my head is like, you know, when I buy a car, I don't care about all the people that go into producing the car. I'm just going to buy the car. You got to figure out how much all these things cost. So what they thought was impossible, they've figured out. It's just their accounting systems didn't make it easy before. So, So now hospitals are starting to post prices. That was only for the last year or so, and they're still not all compliant. So now you have price transparency, so you could shop. Now the question is there a mechanism to shop? So, and everybody's reluctant to do that. You know, you don't shop for your healthcare right now. I would say that if you had an HSA that was populated with money, maybe from your employer, you would actually shop. You'd say, okay, I need an MRI. I'm actually going to look around a little bit. So I can get this one for $300 and this one for $1,500. And by the way, those are like actual numbers of how they vary. There's really no difference. And in fact, quality is usually inversely correlated with price. So there's a website where you can actually search how much any procedure is at any hospital in Wisconsin, and you can compare. So wow. Now for the first time in the world, that's out there. We just don't have a mindset where you shop because people aren't aware that they can or that they should, and there's really no incentive for them to shop yet. So I think we're poised for kind of a revolution in healthcare. It's just the pieces haven't been in place now. And you asked me about John Torinus, and I got onto this little soapbox because I think John is skeptical that price transparency will work because there was no mechanism to make it work. But I think we're really just getting there now. So
the market, it's the mechanism, and there's not enough early adopters yet to really make a difference. Would you agree?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. I don't want to make enemies of everybody, but you know, the AMA does limit the number of physicians. And so if we had a larger number of physicians, that would solve a bit of a supply problem. The other thing is physicians are not aware of the fact that there's a career in direct primary care. They think they need to go to the big providers. So one thing I like to do is lecture to medical students about the economics of healthcare and let them know there are other options out there. And you'd be surprised what they tell me. They're like, well, they never teach us this stuff in medical school. I had no knowledge of economics. I'm like, yeah, wonderful. This is not good. So, you know, and as you think about a physician, and I love physicians. At one point in my life, I wanted to be one. All they care about is helping the patient, and that's awesome. But what you got to realize is the patient's financial health is part of their health. You know, sure. The number one cause of bankruptcies is medical bills that can't be paid. So I do think that, you know, physicians have to be part of that discussion to help a patient navigate this. I'm all about empowering at the level of the provider, the physician, and the patient. And I just think there needs to be some thinking about money now in something like markets. That's where the disruption, I think, can happen.
Decentralization is the antidote for concentration of power, right?
Not that many great thinkers have said that.
Well, Dan, wow, you're blowing my mind here, brother. We got 2 minutes more before we cut the social folks free. We've got one interlocutor slot left. There's a vibrant conversation going on in chat about the benefits of living in Canada, which, by the way, I've heard there isn't quite such. Maybe that's a good question, actually. What do you know about the Canadian healthcare system in our last 2 minutes on social here that, you know, comparisons with the United States? That might be kind of fun to stir the pot and give us some unspeakable content for the second half.
Well, I certainly don't want to get in trouble with my Canadian friends, but in my book, I talk a little bit about the Canadian system. So yeah, there's universal healthcare. That's a wonderful thing, right? But, you know, and people do talk about the weights that you have for certain things, and that's actually real. And there's data on that. And I have some of the data in my book, but there's an average of 60,000 Canadians a year that come to the U.S. for their healthcare, not because it's cheaper, because it's certainly not, but because they don't want to wait 2 months for something they could get in a week or two here. So this is the conundrum, and it's sort of economics 101, is if you're going to provide something universal paid for by the government, resources are limited. That's the fundamental principle of economics. Is there will be rationing. That's just what happens. Like, I mean, there's already rationing now with what we have. You can't get every drug you want. So if there's a drug price controls, there's going to be a formulary. You got to get on the formulary. If you're not on the formulary, you can't have the drug. So you know, if you make something universal, basic economics still apply. It just, there's going to be weights for certain things where there wouldn't be weights. So my advocate in my book is if you want a universal system like Bernie Sanders wants, which I don't want, but if you do want that, just make sure that you also have markets so that people can go outside of the government to get what they want. So,
right on. Dan, one last plug while we're still streaming on social for the book, Purple Solutions. I think your website is purplesolutions.org that got me here, if that's right.
Yes.
All right. So go buy the book. Sorry.